My name is Zeus.
Zeus?
Yeah, Zeus. As in Father of Apollo, Mount Olympus. Don't f*** with me or I'll shove a lightning bolt up your ass. Zeus, you got a problem with that?
Hello everyone and welcome to Risky Business episode number 170. I'm Patrick Gray. Risky Business is brought to you this week by Kaspersky Lab, so thanks very much to them. And as you guessed from the intro, it is the week of Zeus. There is so much news about relating to the Zeus Trojan this week. It's just crazy. We'll get to that in the news in a moment. In this week's feature interview, we'll be taking a look at a proposed bill in the USA that would see all software companies and telcos having to build a lawful interception capability into their products. Basically, the feds in the USA would like to be able to tap services like Skype, BlackBerry's OTR Instant Messenger and so on, and they're preparing a law to that effect. And we've got the perfect guest to discuss this with, Alistair McGibbon, a 15-year veteran of Australia's Federal Police and the founding director of the AFP's High Tech Crime Centre. McGibbon left that job to work as eBay Australia's Director of Trust and Safety, and that was when eBay owned Skype, so he's pretty much the perfect guest. These days he's doing his own thing under the name Surette Group, he joins us soon. In this week's sponsor slot, we're joined by Vitaly Kamluk of Kaspersky Lab in Japan. He's grumpy. He is not pleased. A security researcher in the USA published a nice big detailed blog post the other day in which he described some vulnerabilities that he'd actually found in the Zeus botnet's command and control web application. So many in the security research community believe that disclosure was irresponsible, and Vitaly is one of them. We'll hear from him after this week's feature interview. But first, as always, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, it is the week of Zeus-related news, would you agree?
Yeah, it certainly has been a big week for Zeus. That's being covered in a number of different angles this week.
Number of different angles, number of different outlets, and risky.biz is one of them, but we'll get to that in a bit. I guess the first bit of Zeus-related news that I found extremely interesting is that there's been a new... for those who are unfamiliar, Zeus is a very popular form of banking Trojan. It's developed by some people who are, obviously quite good at developing this stuff and sold on the underground as almost like a little franchise for people to start up their own botnets and do their own fraud. But a new feature has been added to the Zeus botnet toolkit, if you will, which is that it's now capable of infecting mobile phones.
Yeah, so this is a very cool development from the point of view of botnet sophistication. So in this case, what happens is you get the Zeus Trojan on your system, and it attempts to steal the credentials for when you're logging into your bank and things. But as part of the process, it pops up a fake dialog box, which asks for your phone number and model of mobile phone, and then it sends you an SMS with a link to a version of the Zeus Trojan or as a malware specifically designed to run on your particular brand of mobile phone, and then it Trojans your phone and attempts to sniff the one-time passwords being sent to you via SMS by your bank, which is very, very clever.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but Zeus is the Trojan that actually does the man-in-browser stuff that defeats tokens, right?
Yes. I mean, this is pretty much state-of-the-art in terms of getting in between you and your bank and defeating one-time auth mechanisms.
Yeah, and what I really like about this is because it's like it's integrated pwnage, right? That's what I'm choosing to term it, which is that they've... And what is particularly weird about this is I was sort of hypothesizing like how this could be done with a friend of mine the other day, like before this news broke. But what it means is that you have two devices that are more or less paired from the attacker's point of view. You've got their computer and you've got their mobile phone, which means, if there is one-time password sent over SMS, you can match them extremely easily. The other way that I've thought it would make sense for them to own mobile devices is to do it via the syncing mechanism, because more or less you can guarantee that you've got physical access to a phone, right? If you take over someone's computer, you can look for all of the phone related drivers and then send a customized bit of malware via the syncing cable onto the device.
Yeah, well, I think for you know, for modern smartphones, like especially Apple, you know, iPhones and Android ones that, you know, typically users are going to plug into their computer pretty regularly to update their, you know, media or podcasts or whatever. Yeah, those sort of things would be the perfect target for being compromised via fake updates or syncing or that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if you basically got full control over a computer that's going to be physically plugged into this thing, it's as good as having physical access, man. You know, you can do whatever the hell you want to.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's a fascinating development, and I think it's you know, it's really, I think, a watershed moment in the development or the evolution of mobile threats when you've actually got this stuff being integrated into Trojans. It's real. We've talked about it for years, and it's here.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, it's very topical given that last week we were discussing Google's move into using SMF for out-of-band auth for
That's
Google
right.
apps.
Yeah, we were too. And that would probably explain why I was discussing it with a mate later on. But look, moving on to the next Zeus-related bit of news. And it's been doing the rounds in a new successful sort of infection vector, which is LinkedIn mail. It appears to send things like, you know, LinkedIn invites and stuff. And then when people click through, it's bang, you know, auto-pwned, drive-by.
Yeah, I was wondering where all those LinkedIn spams are coming from, because mine must have got a couple of hundred in the last week, and, you know, every other mailbox that I have access to has got at least one of them, and they're getting through the Google spam filters as well. So it's been a very effective spamming run, but in terms of the size, I mean, they're talking about like tens of billions of messages this week related to Zeus propagation via this LinkedIn spam. Like, that's a really big spamming run.
I know. It's pretty impressive, really. I mean, it's just, I mean, Zeus is interesting. I've had a few of the AV guys on talking about it because it's interesting malware and it's an interesting infection system and steals digital certificates and, you know, it does all this funky stuff. But my God, the amount of news that has spat out in the last week involving Zeus is really remarkable.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a sign of what happens when, you know, we start investing real money and, you know, kind of large scale corporatized development of malware. Like, this was where it heads, you know, quite sophisticated, polished, usable packages.
Now, in addition to the news that we've already discussed, dozens, up to 70, it depends which news outlet you follow. I think CNET says about 70, SC Mag says 80. But there's been worldwide in the US, Britain, I think, worldwide arrests of some of the franchisees, I guess you'd call them, criminal organizations using Zeus. There's been, yeah, just an absolute stack of arrests.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of people. Well, they charged 37 people in New York for apparently allegedly more than $3 million being siphoned out of bank accounts, including your personal and some kind of corporate accounts. And there's also other people have been charged with taking money out of, you know, compromised E-Trade accounts, compromised Ameritrade accounts. And they picked up, you know, some of the people actually doing the hacking, some of the money mules. So yeah, it looks like a bit of a roundup.
Yeah,
but I mean, you know, $3 million worth of money out of bank accounts. You know, I'm sure that's a drop in the bucket in terms of what Zeus is actually doing.
You know, this thing apparently it's been described to me as the most popular or most common malware in the world at the moment. So yeah, I'd suggest that your comment about it being a drop in the ocean is probably quite accurate.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least they are managing to track down some people involved. But, I mean, it looks like in this particular case, you know, it's always about how you get the money out of the tubes and into the real world. In this case, apparently the investigation was started in New York when they went to a bank to investigate a suspicious withdrawal. So, like, it's the old-fashioned crime that the police are catching on to and then following up. And, of course, it's leading back, you know, it being the year 2010, leading back to malware and online criminality.
Now, Zeus has even popped up in the headlines of our own risky.biz website. It's over an ethical controversy. I mean, you know, if you wanted an angle from, if you wanted to cover a bit of malware from every single angle, this has never happened, right? That this has all happened in one week. But this guy, Billy Rios, who is a Google security engineer, apparently, that's what his LinkedIn profile says. He maintains a blog, and on that blog, he wrote up this very interesting post about a security audit that he did on the Zeus command and control web application, right? So he found a basic authentication bypass that would enable him to take control of, you know, Zeus botnets. So, you know, the way it's sold is that anyone can buy the whole toolkit and start constructing their own botnet and stuff like that. But, you know, this guy had found a way to if once he'd located the command and control web application, to be able to very easily bypass authentication and take it over. Now, he actually published all of the results, including information that would enable the developers of this use botnet to patch that bug. And they did within 24 hours, as it turns out. And there's a lot of people who aren't happy about that.
Well, of course, you know, it is a very interesting debate, I guess, you know, examining how we do responsible disclosure, if at all, you know, with people who are doing, you know, writing malware. What's interesting, though, of course, is we have exactly the same issues as in the commercial software world where, you know, the vendor has patched it, sure, but what about all the downstream customers, right? You've got, you know, all these unpatched CNC servers out there in the world. So, I mean, even by dropping the bug with full disclosure, as he's done, right? There's still plenty of opportunity for you know, people who want to go and either own a botnet for themselves, or own it and take it down, or you know, whatever the hell they want to do with it, you know, on all the installations that are still out there in the wild. But yeah, no, it's a difficult subject, you know. Exactly what, you know, it's not like you could do, as he, you know, suggests in his blog, you know, emails security at, you know, botnets.ru.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd think that you might want to give that information to an organization like, I don't know, Shadow Server, give it to iDefense, give it to the police. You know what I mean? Like,
and you know, he may well have done so, you know, and he, you know, just didn't come out and say that. But
well, why would you do that and not say it? And why would those same people then get in touch with me and express their disappointment?
Yeah, I could certainly imagine, like, the Shadow Server guys probably would be kind of pissed if they didn't get any advance warning.
I may have had an email. I mean, that's all I'm going to say.
Well, because they may be pissed.
Yeah, they may be pissed about this, and so may a lot of other people, including law enforcement, intelligence, yeah. This, that, right? I mean, you know,
but
this
on the
was
other
a-
hand, right, the Shadow Server guys have been sitting on bugs and Configer for ages, and I mean, then do we see the Configer network being completely disabled by them? Like, I mean, it's still, even if you went and gave that information to someone like the Shadow Server Foundation, like, would they actually use that? Or would they, I mean, from their point of view, is it ethical for them to go around shutting down, you know, shutting down these botnets themselves, right? I mean, it opens them up to a whole bunch of liability and potential problems as well. I mean, it's difficult for everybody. Like, I'm not sure that there is a good answer to this.
Yeah, but I don't think that publicly disclosing a vulnerability in a command and control server is necessarily a good idea. I don't think it's necessary. You know, I can't see a good reason for it.
No, well, the only positive thing I could see that would come out of it is, at least if now someone wants to go vigilante and go burn that shit down, they can, which, you know, previously they might not have been able to.
Yeah.
You kind of spread the blame around by going full disclosure.
I think what's more likely to happen than vigilantes going around there and stealing, you know, the command and controls is that, you know, some of the bad guys will go out there and try to consolidate a bunch of the botnets and take control of them themselves, which means that they can more efficiently conduct their illegitimate operations. So I think that's more likely outcome. And I think this guy probably should have thought of that. Now, I don't know if he's been cooperating with law enforcement or if there's been some, you know, I'm not setting out to condemn the guy, okay? But I'm saying, on the surface of things, it looks like what's happened is he's just gone, you know, I found this bug, that's cool, and he's published it without thinking about how that might upset various people out there in the research community who may have already known about this bug.
Yeah. But no, yeah, as you say, it is, and it's an interesting twist on the full disclosure debate. And, you know, I guess much like the rest of the full disclosure debate, you know, there aren't really any clear answers, which is what makes it such an interesting debate.
Mm-hmm. Now, the story on risky.biz says that it was patched within 3 days, but the guy who actually first identified the patch in the IRC channels, in the Zeus-related IRC channels, his name is Pierre Caron, and he actually tells me now that it was actually patched within 24 hours. So, Adobe, I hope you're paying attention. Now, this is interesting. We've been covering this whole issue of BlackBerry wiretaps over the last couple of months. And the co-CEO of Research in Motion, Jim Balsillie, who I actually interviewed many years ago, who is, considering he's a billionaire, he's like the most remarkably normal dude you've ever spoken to. He's really nice. But he has come up with a way, he believes, that that authorities may be able to wiretap BlackBerries. And it's, you know, pretty simple idea.
I was going to say, it's one of the most sensible suggestions I've heard about this whole topic, which I suppose is good, as you say. It sounds like a pretty sensible sort of dude. So, yeah, he suggested that, you know, if governments want to eavesdrop on communications from, you know, companies that are using BlackBerries, they should just go ask the companies for the keys.
They can subpoena the keys from the companies.
And that seems pretty reasonable to me. It's not like they, you know, if you know, the crypto is end to end with the BlackBerry Enterprise product, then, you know, it's not like RIM can do anything about it. So, yeah, it's kind of nice for them to finally come out and go, well, hey, you know, you guys, why don't you go deal with the problem at the root cause instead of blaming us for it?
It's interesting. It makes covert warrants and stuff a little bit more tricky. And I guess if, you know, if you've got some criminal organization running their own BlackBerry Enterprise server through some sort of front company, then perhaps...
they've still got some problems. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, realistically, I think we know what else I'm going to say.
Now, oh, Cyberstorm 3 is kicking off at the moment. I thought that was worth mentioning. It happens every 2 years. Australia participates, as does Canada. I think you guys even participate, don't you?
Yep, there's some cyberstorming going on over here. I'm reliably informed.
Are you taking part?
No, that's a little too white hat fed spook sellout for me, man. You know, I'm hardcore. I keep it real on the streets. Not like the other sellouts around here.
Which one of you sheep shaggers is into it?
Oh, I couldn't possibly disclose that information, though. Like a it's very confidential. I hear it's, you know. Sorry, I just got kicked. Yeah, there goes my security clearance, right?
Yeah. All right. Now, well, you know, just worth a mention anyway. So good luck to all you guys who are taking part in Cyberstorm 3.
If you're planning on carrying out a denial of service attack, then, you know, I guess it would be a good time to do it now.
Or a bad time, because this is when everyone's actually sitting around, you know, being really paranoid, watching their border.
Nah, they'll just get confused by it, don't worry.
Yeah, yeah, I probably think it's part of the exercise, yeah.
Exactly.
Fun. Okay, moving on. Now, this story I pulled off the wires, another one from CNET, a lot of news from CNET this week, written by Eleanor Mills, so thank you, Eleanor. Interesting. Because Comcast, which is actually a cable company in the United States and the largest residential ISP there, they've got basically a service starting up. I believe it's actually opt-in, but for its internet customers, where if they get infected with some sort of bot, it will, you know, when they're browsing the internet, they get a warning popping up saying you've been infected with the virus. Click here to some, you know, safe area where you can download Norton and whatever. Now, when I first read that, I mean, on the surface of things, people are saying this is a really good idea. But when you dig a little bit deeper, how did rogue antivirus guys actually get their badness installed on your system?
They may think that they spawn a pop-up that says you've got a Trojan and you should download this piece of antivirus. Hang on a second. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, facepalm, right? Yeah. This is just conditioning people, in my mind, this is just conditioning people to actually trust... You know, trust warnings thrown up by their browser that tell them they're infected with viruses.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, you kind of want to say nice things about it because it sounds like, you know, they're trying to do the right thing. But yeah, realistically, like, is this going to backfire? Probably yes.
Yeah, no, it's really sad when you see people trying to do the right thing and just failing.
Yeah, no, they're definitely paddling the fail boat up the creek there, man.
I think the one saving grace, though, of this scheme is that it will also email customers. So I guess, you know, if they're getting the email and the pop up on the browser, maybe it's going to be a little bit effective. But yeah, it's the problem with this sort of stuff, isn't it, that you just can't trust email and you can't trust browsers. Perhaps if they were offering to ring their customers, it would be a good idea.
But I'm sure that would be far too expensive.
Well, I don't know. And then there's all the call centers who are doing that malware stuff via Windows Event Manager as well.
Yeah,
so,
true, actually, yeah.
So I think
we're screwed everywhere.
We're screwed, man. The bad guys are too good. Run away. Run away. All right. Very quickly, Microsoft has issued an out-of-band patch for that ASP.NET padding Oracle attacks thingy.
Yep, and this is, you know, it's pretty serious business if you're running, you know, SharePoint or anything kind of, you know, .NET-y on the tubes. So yeah, definitely get patching, dudes.
Go get patched. And bouncing back very quickly to Comcast and a couple of guys, this is kind of funny, kind of tragic, right? A couple of guys who defaced Comcast.net. They basically hijacked the domain and then passed it, you know, redirected it to a screen that was like a shout out to another crew or whatever. Those guys have been busted and sentenced to 18 months. You know,
it seems pretty harsh, you know, 18 months in jail for dropping Comcast's DNS. And, you know, really, like, I mean, okay, Comcast are claiming that it cost them, what was it, like $128,000 worth of downtime or, you know, whatever.
Well, it also dropped their webmail for all of their customers for 5 hours, right? Which is, you know, means that these guys obviously shouldn't escape punishment completely.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I agree, right? I mean, it's still kind of a jerk move. But on the other hand, right, I mean, if it takes them 5 hours to recover from something going wrong with their webmail, I mean, it kind of suggests that, you know, maybe they need to be able to respond to things going wrong better.
Oh, I don't know, though.
I mean, it cost them less.
A full sort of domain name hijacking, you know, that can be a real pain in the ass to reverse.
True, okay, yeah, so, true, fair enough.
But,
yeah.
but But the funny part about this story, when you're reading through it, is they actually, they almost chickened out of doing it, right? They actually seized the domain and they changed the contact information for the domain to one of the guy's email addresses. And then they used, for street address, they used dildo room at 69 Dictard Lane. Right?
And then classy stuff, yes.
Well, this is what's funny is they actually contacted Comcast's existing contact for the domain at his home number to tell him that they'd done this, like as basically saying, look, we pwned your DNS. We pwned your domain name and, you know, you really want to fix this. And the guy hung up on them. So then that was when they defaced it.
Yeah. Well, I guess the moral of the story is when hackers come calling, you know, maybe they'll tell them to go f*** themselves.
Hell pizza. Hell pizza. Going to eat some pizza tonight, Adam.
Maybe it'll be homemade.
Maybe. All right, Adam, well, that's it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
You're welcome, Pat. Talk to you next time.
Adam Boileau with a look at the week's mostly Zeus botnet-related news headlines there. I think that's the first time that's ever happened when we've done this this show, that there's been such a common thread among all of the news. Anyway, it's time for this week's feature interview now, and we're taking a look at a rather controversial proposition in the United States. On Monday, the New York Times published a piece headlined US Tries to Make It Easier to Wiretap the Internet. It outlined a bill proposed by the FBI, Justice Department, and National Security Agency to require all services, and I'm quoting from the story here, all services that enable communications, including encrypted email transmitters like BlackBerry, social networking websites like Facebook, and software that allows direct peer-to-peer messaging like Skype, to be technically capable of complying if served with a wiretap order. Now, the Obama administration is apparently on board with this proposal and will submit the bill to lawmakers next year, according to that report. Well, I'm guessing 90% of you out there already think this is a crackheaded idea, but hey, you're all filthy, dirty hackers, so that's to be expected. So I thought I'd find the squarest dude I know and ask him what he thought. Now, that man is Alastair McGibbon. He is so square, you could use him to calibrate those carpenter's squares. Kids, they use Alastair McGibbon to get, you know, the perfect 90-degree angle on protractors. You know who to thank for angles. It's Alastair McGibbon, especially the square angles. Now, he was, why do I say he's square? Well, he was with the Australian Federal Police for 15 years, which is a very good start. He worked on drug and intelligence cases before he founded the AFP's High Tech Crime Centre. After that, he left to work for eBay as its Australian Arms Director of Trust and Safety. At that time, eBay actually owned Skype, so Al's experience there is also quite relevant to this topic. So these days, he's an independent consultant operating under the name Surette Group. And guess what? He seems to think that this is a crackheaded idea as well. I spoke to him by phone earlier this week, and here's what he had to say.
Well, on the one hand, I'm obviously very highly sympathetic to law enforcement agencies looking to obviously enforce laws in nations and protect the individuals within those nations. I mean, that's what they're really designed to do. And telecommunications interception laws are a critical part of modern day investigations. Having said that, I must say that it strikes me as a little bit technically backward or impossible in what they're suggesting. So on the one hand, we take all the advantages of cloud computing, the advantages of peer-to-peer communications like Skype, and then we tell them that they need to attach boilers and coal-fired things to the end of them.
Yes, it does read and, rather like coal-fired IP telephony, doesn't it?
Yeah, it just strikes me as, look, again, highly sympathetic. I don't believe in absolute freedom or absolute privacy. There is no such thing. You don't have a right to privacy from the state if you're breaking laws, for example.
This is really one of the reasons why I wanted to speak to you about this, because I think there's a really strong view in the community that our right to privacy is absolute, and it never has been, has it?
No, it hasn't. No, of course not. I mean, you know, you just need to look at pretty much any of the powers that are given to police under common law and other things that show you just the level of infringement of your privacy and your liberty that can be undertaken by police. That's, I don't think, what the real question is. The real question is whether or not this is going to be an effective attempt to, I guess, heal or get technology. technology, communications technologies to heal. I just don't think you can.
Well, me neither, which is why I guess I'm more interested in the philosophical aspects of this. Now, namely because Alistair, we've never really had the means to have private communications in the past, which is perhaps why people are starting to form the expectation that now that they can use all of this, you know, encryption, all these encryption goodies, they should be able to. And if the police want to surveil them, they can do other things like install listening devices in a premises.
Well, the thing is, the police can't, right? And what I was going to say is that in Australia, for example, just as in the US, internet service providers need to have an interception capability. So, for example, the police could obtain a warrant to intercept encrypted communications going in and out of my home via my ISP. And they could do that, including if I'm using Skype, for example. What they won't be able to necessarily do is understand what it is that I'm saying or sending or reading or writing, right? But I guess the point is then they need to get better at cracking that encryption themselves. We need to develop almost, and this is the trade-off, of course, with encryption, is law enforcement agencies need to start developing much greater capabilities to crack strong encryption, which can be done, right? I mean, that's what national security agencies do.
Yeah, but that's the National Security Agency that hires more mathematics PhDs than any other single organisation on the planet. And, you know, I know you love the AFP and you spent 15 years there, but you guys don't have, it's not you guys anymore, I know, but the AFP certainly doesn't have anywhere near the resources required to do that sort of research.
This is where governments will have to legislate to allow, this is where people who are really hardcore on civil liberties will end up forcing the hand of government, is they will have to allow the agencies that can break strong codes to be used under very strict and monitored conditions to help break codes in criminal matters domestically. But what I would also say is that's not the only solution. I mean, police agencies use criminal informants, they use listening devices, they use physical surveillance. They use the fact that criminals make mistakes on a very regular basis as ways to continue their investigation. So just because the door in relation to maybe encrypted peer-to-peer communications is closing from a law enforcement point of view, it doesn't mean that others aren't open. For example, when police actually execute a search warrant and take a computer and analyse what's on that computer, there can be huge amounts of evidence relating to my activities compared to the past where I didn't actually have everything written down and recorded that I undertook, whereas now my smartphone that I'm using, the laptop that I have at home, all of those things afford a huge amount of evidence about sometimes my geolocation, sometimes my, the actual communications I've undertaken are sitting there in the clear on my computer or my smartphone. So those things themselves are actually a boon to law enforcement. So what I'm arguing is that while I'm highly sympathetic to governments who believe they have a lawful right to intercept communications, and we have to accept that that's what law enforcement does to protect the rest of us, maybe they won't be able to do it as often, at least for those people who are going to be using those peer-to-peer encrypted technologies. We can't be going about forcing, and the Americans need to be very careful about trying to force services that operate in their jurisdiction to be opening up an office within the curtilage of the United States so they can intercept communications. I mean, that's a pretty dangerous step for a country that has prided itself on seeing the internet grow and build the concept of democracy and freedom of speech. And this is always going to be the trade-off. So on the one hand, I'm highly sympathetic. On the other, I'm just not sure whether it's going to achieve what the advocates want.
Oh, look, I'm almost certain that it won't, Alistair. And I wonder if there's a perhaps easier solution for law enforcement that they just haven't considered, which is the development of, I mean, this sort of stuff has been internet folklore since the dawn of time, but I mean, I don't see why law enforcement agencies, instead of trying to crack state-of-the-art crypto, I mean, Skype crypto is actually pretty good, and I don't think that law enforcement agencies, or I think even the intelligence agencies, are probably having a reasonably difficult time with it. What I would suggest, though, would be a lot easier is for law enforcement agencies to develop some sort of law enforcement Trojan that they could put on the system's covert warrant, no knock warrant, go in, put it on the system, and then Bob's your mother's brother. Away you go. And then you know, you've fulfilled your interception requirement. You haven't had to, you have not had to mandate or legislate any requirements on any software makers whatsoever.
Yes. I mean, so compromising the end computer is clearly a very legitimate way to get your hands in a lawful way on the communications.
And is it something that ever happened during your time with the Australian Federal Police?
Well, you'll actually see that there are legislative capabilities to do that.
So, but is it something that happens, Alistair, I guess is what I'm asking?
Yeah, look, I would imagine it does get done. Patrick, I'd imagine it does.
You'd imagine it does, or you know that it does?
I imagine it does under, you know, really strict circumstances.
But do you know that, Alistair?
Proper and lawful circumstances.
But Patrick, do you know that this is something that happens, or is this just something that you imagine happens? Is this something that happened while you worked at the Australian High Tech Crime Centre?
No, I would say that it is clearly a tool that's within the arsenal of law enforcement, just like physical surveillance or, you know, informants or other such things. So it's just, it is clearly technically feasible, as you've said. It's lawful to do. And it's therefore sensible that it's an option that law enforcement might pursue.
So why doesn't this idea completely render this proposed bill pointless? I mean, I suppose in the example of Blackberries and things like that, but you know, you put a listening device in the car, you put a listening device in the house, in the office, it's probably more expensive.
Well, but Blackberries aren't immune from vulnerabilities either, I'd say. I mean, you know, just because there may not be many in the wild doesn't mean, of course, at some point someone doesn't, you know, work out on a wholesale way to compromise BlackBerry. So there are lots of different things that can also happen. So I guess what I'm saying, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, there's lots of ways to skin this cat. But I think people would be wrong if they say it's wrong for government to want to intercept communications, because it's just a fact of life that they do, and it's there to protect the broader community. It's lawful. It's been done for a long time, largely not abused by law enforcement. And there's a whole range of checks and balances in place. In fact, Australia is a very heavy user of telecommunications interception on a per capita basis, and it's a fact of life. Mm. It's not done lightly by any agency that I've ever dealt with. The reality is that if that starts failing as a way to get stuff just in the clear over the wires, then there'll have to be other ways, like, you, as you say, compromising the end computer lawfully, still doing your lawful intercept and breaking the crypto if it's weak, or if there are agencies that can assist, criminal informants, made by criminals. Sometimes people think they've got hard encryption turned on. It's not. You know, it's a bit like your wireless at home.
I like the idea too of a BlackBerry. I mean, just thinking off the top of my head, remotely compromising a BlackBerry is kind of tricky without, you know, tricking the user, but you could always just go to the telco and get them to, you know, have the phone throw an error every time it throws an outbound call, then ring up the user and say, look, there's a problem with your phone, bring it in and we will fix it for you. You know, I mean, problem solved, right? I mean, you know, this is what I'm suggesting. It seems that you're agreeing with me that lateral thinking and good investigations will be a perfectly adequate substitute for this bill, which is only going to stymie innovation and be a major pain in the ass for everyone.
Well, look, again, I do agree with you that what this will require is just more lateral thinking on the part of agencies. I honestly can't see the bill succeeding. And not that I understand US politics. I suspect most Americans don't either. But I just can't see it flying in a place like America. And it would be the only country, only sort of Western country, that would ever dare to even consider such a thing. The rest of us could only dare to dream to have such authority over the internet, and you know, frankly, there's more fruitful areas to pursue in relation to, again, retention of data, obtaining lawfully information that has been sent over various networks. I mean, those are all good things, and they're necessary. The people that operate on the internet are not immune from those laws, as they quickly discover, and it's appropriate. But again, it needs to be just one of the tools in the toolbox for law enforcement.
I think can I paraphrase what you're saying? You're basically telling the FBI to suck it up and try harder, right?
I would never dare to say that, Patrick. What I would say to them is I can understand fully why they're saying what they're saying. I just don't know whether I would be pursuing that. And clearly there are going to be some very powerful, very articulate, very technically savvy lobby groups that are going to come out and show all the reasons why this won't work.
Now, just going back to something you said earlier, which is you can imagine that the intelligence agencies would assist in criminal matters with breaking crypto. Is this something that you have known? Is this something that has happened, to your knowledge?
I'm not too sure where the legislation stands in the US, or indeed how one uses intelligence agencies broadly on domestic matters. But I think it's something that governments would need to very clearly legislate or work out what the lawful regime was for the use of services.
So the AFP and the DSD haven't been collaborating on interceptions, for example?
Oh, that's clearly not for me to be saying. That's for AFP and DSD to be saying.
Your experience at the AFP, did that ever happen?
It's not a place for me to be talking about. But what I would say is that if you've got powerful computers and people that know how to break code, then it would make sense that you would look to use those people if it's lawful to do so and proper to do so. And if there's a good reason to do so, then I see, again, if it's lawful and it's for good reason, then I would hope people do.
And in your experience as the director of the Australian High Tech Crime Centre, was that something that did happen during your tenure there?
I think crypto in terms of its hands, I guess its consumer level really hasn't been an issue until quite recently. I mean, people have talked about encryption for a long time, and I just never saw it as a real problem. I think one of the biggest issues was actually all the different types of different ways in which data was transmitted rather than encryption.
So you're thinking more like instant messenger protocols and stuff like that rather than actually trying to get Skype stuff.
Yeah. So all of the protocols that would be required to actually, understand, let alone decrypt. But it's with the rise of things like Skype, it's with the rise of the ability to really use, I guess, a much more consumer-friendly encryption that I think the issue has come to the fore, and that's well after my time in the AFP, and clearly it didn't bother us at all. In fact, eBay owned Skype, so what I would say, at least for a time, that Skype would say to you that it can't intercept these communications or decrypt them because the keys are held at either end of the conversation, and the conversation doesn't go through any central servers run by the company. Therefore, it's just a really hard thing to do from a corporate point of view. Mm-hmm. And from a Skype point of view, to have to, and not that I speak for that company, but to have to build, servers that all these communications go through kills the whole concept of Skype. I mean, it kills every concept of what Skype stands for. So I can't see, I genuinely can't see the US government doing this. I could be surprised, of course. I mean, there's lots of politics that come to play to make these things happen. But again, I would just say to you that I think encryption is clearly increasingly a problem. There's no doubt. I think they're very genuine, these agencies, when they say that. I don't know what current arrangements they have between themselves, if there indeed are arrangements and what the lawful way in which they do that is. But what I would say is that it's clearly something they need to consider, along with, as you said, compromising the end computer, along with maintaining physical surveillance, along with having informants and all those other things. And along with sometimes simply executing a search warrant and seizing stuff.
Yeah, like the, finding out where the big room full of drugs is and, catching them there.
Well, absolutely. If you still want to physically, grab the drugs at the same time, it's probably the best proof of what you're up to.
All right, mate. Well, look, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a chat about this. It's a fascinating topic, and I guess we'll just have to wait and see how it all comes out in the wash.
Thanks, Patrick. I'll speak to you soon.
Alistair McKibben there with a chat about that proposed bill in the USA. So big thanks to Al Mack for joining us. I know he was actually pretty busy at the time. So big thanks, Al Mack. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview. And as you would know, if you're a regular listener, our sponsors get to come onto the show every week to have a yarn about current events. And this week, we're chatting with Kaspersky Labs' Vitaly Kamluk about the decision by apparent security engineer Billy Rios to publicly disclose a vulnerability in the command and control web application used by the Zeus botnet. Vitaly joined me by phone from Japan a couple of days ago to discuss this topic. And keep in mind, when we had this chat, we both were not aware that the vulnerability in the CNC server had already been fixed. But here's Vitaly with his thoughts.
a lot of developers were disappointed by the disclosure of this information, because many people knew about it, but they didn't want to report to the bad guys, because in some cases, this vulnerability, this weakness could be used in law enforcement investigations, you know, in estimating the number of bots in a particular botnet based on the Zeus malware. Now the bad guys will obviously fix the bugs, and it won't be available for the researchers and for the law enforcement anymore.
So, I mean, how much time do researchers with Kaspersky, just as an example, how much time do they spend actually looking for these sorts of vulnerabilities? Because I imagine that they would be very useful to anti-malware companies.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I can say that we are spending a lot of time and a lot of resources looking for such vulnerabilities. But, you know, when we get the code from time to time, we can obviously see the weaknesses which are normally present in, you know, in all software products. And we usually target, you know, and check the legitimate products. So we have some experience in that area of protecting against the vulnerabilities. And when we see the malicious code, we can see the weaknesses as well. So we have a collection of such things, but we don't think it's reasonable to disclose it publicly.
It came as a bit of a surprise to me that this guy disclosed it. I mean, he works for Google as well. I mean, it seems strange to me that someone who works for such a high-profile company would release this information and not really make any attempt to conceal, you know, the fact that they work for Google on their security team.
True enough. What I have seen from the security community, the reaction was people were disappointed, and they tried to understand what was wrong, why did he do that, what was his motivation. And some people, they tried to talk to him before he posted it, but he refused hiding the post and not disclosing information. But the people from the security community, they started thinking of kind of ethics and policies for the security researchers in community to disclose information like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's the sort of research that I imagine would be most beneficial if you shared it with other people in the security community. But it's not stuff that you want to share openly. So how do you decide who should get access to that sort of information?
Well, normally there is in security community, in between security vendors, there are trusted relationship. So there are people we know, there are people we trust, and people we can share information with. There are special gatherings and meetings where this information can be shared, but of course it's not public. And you know, we know all these people we share information with, but when you go public, of course, it will end up in the bad guys' attention. So yeah, they will use it to become stronger.
How long do you think it will take them to actually patch this problem?
Well, for the software developer, it would take probably half an hour, I think.
Because I think on his post he said that it would actually be quite difficult to fix.
Well, I don't think so. I have some experience in software development as well and in patching the vulnerabilities, so I would say that it will take me 30 minutes to patch it, but it may probably take longer to update all the CNCs because there are pretty lot of them, but the fix is not the problem. The problem is probably just updating all the servers.
So actually just deploying the fix would be more of an issue.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess I guess you would encourage anyone out there working on similar things to, I suppose, rather than, you know, releasing that information on a blog, perhaps, you know, pass it around to other friends in the security industry and spread it on the grapevine a bit. Is that what you think would be appropriate?
Yeah, exactly. And it will be credited. It will be accepted very well, and you know, it will be respected in the community of the researchers. You know, like the guy who wants to share this information, who found it, and well, he will be famous in the certain circles of people, but you know, not as the guy who broke some ethical rules, but you know, as a trusted and proved researcher.
Did you say earlier that Kaspersky was aware of this vulnerability already?
It's not about our company. I mean, we didn't know about this specific vulnerability, but there are other CNCs and there are other botnets and other code which we analyzed, and we know the existence of vulnerabilities in them.
So you're holding similar information that affects different botnets.
Yeah, exactly. But about this specific, well, me personally, I didn't know about it, so it was new for me. I didn't work too close on the Zeus CNC, to be honest. But the other guys probably did in the company, so I can't tell for the whole company.
All right. Well, Vitaly Kamluk, thank you very much for joining us with your thoughts on the release of that code.
Thank you.
Vitaly Kamluk on the line from Japan there, and big thanks to Kaspersky Lab for sponsoring this week's edition of the show. And that's it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.